You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2026 Tour de France, brought to you by MyWoosh.
Yes, Graham, MyWoosh is an indoor cycling platform, ideal for anyone who just likes riding a bike, whether you want to just click over those virtual kilometres or test yourself to the limit in some racing. But it's also a welcoming, authentic place for cyclists to come together. They're building a great community on the MyWoosh platform. And so when you get on your bike and you get the screen up in front of you, you can join the community, ride around with lots of other people.
You won't be Baptiste Verstroffer riding out there alone, will you?
No, you won't. You'll have some company at least. So MyWoosh, you can download the app from your app store. There's a link in our show notes, or go to mywoosh.com to find out more. And I'm particularly looking forward to getting home from the tour and on those kind of late summer evenings when it's a bit too dark to get out on the roads, I'll hook up my bike to MyWoosh and I'll remember all this, Graham. I'll be enjoying the flat stages much more than the mountains, that's for sure.
But we're not wishing it away just yet.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2026 Tour de France with Lionel Burney and Graham Wilgos, brought to you by MyWoosh. Today we are in Bordeaux.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Bordeaux, Graham, the centre of Bordeaux, outside a busy little bar. We were trying to get a table at the Sherlock Holmes, a pub, an English pub in Bordeaux called the Sherlock Holmes. Basically, Sherlock Holmes was a big fan, a connoisseur of claret, wasn't he, in the Arthur Conan Doyle books? And so there's a bit of a reciprocal love affair between Bordeaux and Sherlock Holmes.
I wonder what was coming there. I thought it might be Watson.
You're very much Watson to my Sherlock Holmes today, yeah, I think. I mean, you're suffering from the effects of the oppressive heat here. But as I say that, there's a lovely breeze. There's a lovely breeze. The heat has intensified today, I think. It's got a lot more humid. And I think lots of people are suffering as a result.
There's a lot of pubs, bars, even our hotel is named for an Englishman.
Yeah, we're in the Winston Churchill. Do you know why?
Well, I don't know specifically why with Churchill, but I know that Bordeaux was under English rule for a long time, just over 300 years.
Okay, well, I think the Winston Churchill connection is from the Second World War, 1940, when the French government was retreating from Paris and they basically retreated as far as Bordeaux, and they were keen to sign some kind of surrender to the Germans, and Winston Churchill didn't want that to happen and wanted to keep the French in the war. And there was a bit of a standoff between Bordeaux and London for a while, but Winston Churchill prevailed. And so there's a kind of an affectionate link there too, because it kind of signalled the resistance, the fight back for the Allies against Nazi Germany. So we're in the Winston Churchill this evening. Will we be enjoying some claret later? I don't know.
Doubtful. Too warm for that today. I'm just going to underline that with the era under English rule began in 1152 when Duchess Eleanor of Aquitaine married Henri Plantagenet, who soon became Henry II of England. And that basically meant for a long time, merchants of Bordeaux enjoyed special privileges under English rule. They were exempt from taxes on their wines.
Ah.
So it goes back a lot further than Churchill. But we saw...
So you could get a nice Margaux without having to pay the duty.
Indeed. Mm. We saw a fight back of a different sort today.
We did, but we're in Bordeaux, the place that has hosted more Tour de France stage finishes than anywhere other than Paris, of course. People might be wondering why Bordeaux was such a fixture on the Tour de France route. Of course, it was on the very first tour route in 1903, so that's one reason. But basically, it comes down to the fact that the race director for many decades after the Second World War, Jacques Godet, who you mentioned yesterday, the prize for going over the Tourmalet first, the Jacques Godet prize. He was the race director, the Christian Prudhomme of the day, for a long, long time, until into the 1980s when he paired up with Félix Levitin. Anyway, Godet was the boss of the Tour de France for years, and he was very good friends with a politician called Jacques Chaban-Delmas, who just so happened to be the mayor of Bordeaux from, I think, 1947 to 1995. And the Tour was an almost permanent fixture on the route in all of those years. It became almost the unofficial world championships of sprinting. And
Sprinter's Paradise, it's still kind of affectionately known as, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's anyone in sprinting, certainly since the sort of 70s and into the 80s and 90s, has won here. Then Mark Cavendish won a stage here in 2010, and the Tour didn't come back for 13 years. Now, that was because the Greens were in power, and a lot of cities and towns that have got Green mayors basically turned their back slightly, or had turned their back slightly, on the Tour de France on the basis that it's a sort of polluting behemoth. Cycling itself is very green, but the Tour, with its publicity caravan throwing out plastic goodies and all of that, the mayor of Lyon, I think it was, once said, how many internal combustion engines does it need to get the cyclists round France? Which was a bit of a cutting comment. Anyway, Bordeaux say that the reason they didn't host the Tour for that period of time was more because of the cost. The cost of hosting a stage finish had rocketed up to about 150,000 euros. And they chose to host other things. Rugby World Cup, for example. But it came back in 2023. And there's a lot of kind of green, active travel infrastructure in Bordeaux. Cycling, walking, lovely tram we saw earlier. So the Tour is very much back on the agenda in Bordeaux.
So today, was that the sprint siren we heard, Lionel?
It certainly was, wasn't it? As happened in Pau 2 days ago, we had a sprint finish. But also, we had a familiar face in the... Well, it wasn't a lone breakaway this time, was it? But the French rider Baptiste Vestroffer of Lotto Antimarché, he attacked one of the first to go, and he was joined. I bet he was glad to look round and see that he was joined by somebody, a nice friend for a day out in the sunshine, Jakub Otruba, Czech rider with Caja Rural, and they rode off the front.
But as soon as they did, the bunch slowed up almost immediately, didn't it?
Of course, of course. Signal for a nice relaxing day, but they kept the gap well in hand once again, didn't they? There was no way that Vestroffer and Otruba were going to go to the finish. But that makes it, for Vestroffer, well over 300k in the breaks in the space of 3 days.
We saw him do it on stage two. We saw him do it on stage five. He was animating the race. And he's done it again today.
He has indeed. And we saw Alpecin, Premier Tech and Sudal Quickstep sharing the workload just to keep the gap reasonable.
Can I give you a Baptiste Vestroffer quote before? He spoke to L'Equipe. L'Equipe basically asked him, you know, why he was out on his own all day. And he said, look, if I hadn't done it, the day could have been very, very long for the fans. So he's French rider at the front of the Tour de France too. He's getting a lot of love out on the road when he's on his own, and did so again today in a pair, in that sort of two-man time trial that was out for most of the day. He didn't expect to make it on stage five, but he said afterwards that there is still a little something in the back of your head telling you, and what if all the planets aligned, but you'd have to be crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no way it was going to make it all the way to the finish today, even with a bit of help in the breakaway. But they left it till the sort of final phase, didn't they? Before that, we had the intermediate sprint. Once again, Mads Pedersen collected as many points as were available to him by taking third behind two breakaway riders. Biniam Gamay fourth, Max Kanter fifth, Jasper Philipsen sixth, and Tim Mahler seventh. So not, you know, opening it up and giving it full gas at the intermediate sprint. Perhaps he was telling us something there.
Perhaps he was. I noticed the peloton strung out with about 12 kilometres to go before the intermediate sprint. So they got themselves organised, and they got themselves organised in very good time. But Pedersen worked really hard to do it, to collect those points. He was sort of at the back of the front of the bunch, if that makes sense, and he sort of launched first and took it all the way to the line for the best of the rest behind the break.
Yeah. One of the other features of today was that the Uno X riders were very, very active. They, of course, lost Torstein Train this morning. He crashed in the yellow jersey yesterday, lost the yellow jersey. I made the remark that it was the end of the line for him as far as the yellow jersey was concerned yesterday. Well, it was the end of his Tour de France today because he didn't start due to the injuries. But Uno X went out on the front foot. Around about 120k to go, they were trying something, but they were shut down by Soudal and Alpecin.
They like to gamble, don't they, Uno X?
And they had another few goes in the last 25k, didn't they, with the same riders. It was Jonas Abrahamsson and Skarseth who were sort of taking it in turns to have a go to get off the front. But there were enough organised sprint teams to keep a lid on things, and as we came into the final couple of kilometres, Alpecin Premier Tech looked like they had it exactly how they wanted it. They had four riders there, Philipsen of course on the back of the train, but when it came to the final sprint, did Philipsen go too early? He launched it. He was the first big name to go. He squeezed the Cajaroral rider Fernando Gaviria a bit on the right-hand side of the barriers, but Gaviria managed to hold it upright. But Philipsen had gone, and he basically misjudged it because Tim Melier came streaking down the left-hand side to win the stage. His fourth Tour de France stage win in his career. He won two last year, didn't he?
He did.
In Dunkirk, and then he was the winner in Châteauroux the day that Mathieu van der Poel and his teammate went off on that crazy break. Both times he beat Jonathan Milan. But Tim Melier, a big win for him, especially as Bart van Leerberger, one of his
key lead-out men.
Yeah, key lead-out man, was out of the race yesterday, pulled out yesterday.
DNF'd yesterday, didn't he?
Big victory for Soudal Quickstep, and it always feels like they're one of the teams that we always look at because they expect to win stages, especially in the Patrick Lefebvre era when he was here on the ground. And whenever they don't win a stage in the first week, the pressure really ramps up, particularly from the Belgian press.
Yeah, and it's been really, it's for the sprinters, it's been so tough. We need to keep this in mind to get to stage seven. They've not had that much opportunity. They've had to go up and over the Tourmalet already. The first three stages were raced at a frenetic pace in Barcelona and then up and over the Pyrenees. So anyone who still had the legs today has done remarkably well in that kind of conservation game.
Yeah, absolutely, and especially as they, you know, they got kind of done by Olav Kooi a couple of days ago, didn't they? And the likes of Melier and Philipsen probably felt they had something to prove. And I mean, I joked about it in our preview episode, Graham, about how the sprinting this year with perhaps six opportunities, if we're being really generous. I mean, tomorrow's another 70-point stage with the extra points for the green jersey. So we know that that is highly likely to be a sprint. But there's more sprinters than there are stages available. So it is already a game of musical chairs, isn't it? And Jasper Philipsen will be starting to get itchy feet and feeling pretty nervous when each time the music stops.
For sure. And you get the feeling that all is not quite well in the Alpecin de Koninck camp insofar as putting him in the right position. And possibly there's even a question over Jasper Philipsen's legs. He won last time we were here, of course. Someone else who has won here, Tom Steels, the Soudal Quickstep DS. He won here way back in 1999. He was in charge today for his team. He talked us through the sprint.
It was a big fight, I must say, the whole day. But then, how do you say that, Captain Mouse play with the breakaway was not easy. But then once into the final, the last five was really a big, big hectic fight. And they lost each other, they found each other. And luckily, they all had experience to find it. But then once they got into the final straight, a big of a fight with Gaviria, I lost positions again. But then he showed his claws and once he had the space and he could go, he's the fastest. It's always special to win a stage, but there are some cities that make it extra special. And Bordeaux is a sprinter city, and a lot of sprinters won here. That makes it also nice to put that cross away that you won here. So congrats to Tim.
I wondered if Tom Steels had happy memories of Bordeaux, because in 1997 he pulled out of the race on the way to Bordeaux the day after he'd actually been relegated to last place in the group for throwing a bidon at Freddy Moncassin, French sprinter. in the sprint finish in Marraine.
It's wonderfully petulant, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, have you seen the video on YouTube? I mean, it's a brilliant aim. The fact they're going at sort of 60k an hour, and I mean, look, I'm not endorsing this at all, listeners, by the way. Extremely dangerous thing to do, but he did do it in one smooth movement. He picked his bottle up in the heat of the moment and launched it at Freddy Moncassin. And luckily, no one sort of crashed. Nothing, you know, it could have gone terribly wrong, that. But he was afterwards nicknamed Tom Bidon for quite a few years. But like you say, he was back on top in 99 and won here that year.
Another sprinter who's very familiar with Bordeaux is Tor Hushovd, who wore the green jersey into Bordeaux back in 2010 on the day that Mark Cavendish won here. He's now a DS at Uno X. It almost happened for them today with Soren Warrenskold. Here's how he saw it.
It was a case of almost today. What almost went so right for you?
I mean, he was well positioned. He had the speed. He's in good shape. I don't know if you have some regrets, but if you do, I think it's good, because then you know even stronger that he can win and beat all the best sprinters in the world and win the stage in Tour de France. And that's what it's all about. That's what we're aiming for. And today, Søren Warrenskold proved that he's one of them.
And it would have been a lovely footnote having said goodbye to Torsten before today's stage as well. How's his condition?
No, he's of course down, but he also understands that this part of the sport, part of cycling. So, and also, like we talked a lot about, he have to look what they've been through, which is a nice memory. So stick with his good memories and take that with you. And that's what he do today. And I'm sure that he's prouder to see that we already now kind of turn it around and we up there for the win.
What's the team's strategy from here for the rest of the race, or the rest of the week even?
I think we're gonna race like we always do. Also what we did again today, offensive, attack and stuff like this, and try to win stages like we also did today. So take every opportunity.
I think there might be a corrections corner coming up here, Graham, because I heard something that was slightly incorrect.
I'm so embarrassed. I can only blame the heat. I knew exactly what I wanted to ask him, but to call the possibility of winning a stage at the Tour de France, or even winning a stage at the Tour de France, a footnote. What I wanted to say really was, look, they've worn the yellow jersey. The leader of the race has gone home in a Torstein train, and bouncing back today with a stage win would have been spectacular. But yeah, I can only blame the heat. It was oppressively hot around by the buses with zero shade, but mea culpa, absolutely not a footnote. So apologies, Uno X and Tor Hushovd.
They got close, didn't they? I mean, Soren Warrenskold there, I mean, Tim Malia was a comfortable winner, but he was definitely a solid second, and they were working well together into the final stages, Uno X. Let's just run through the top sort of few places, because Biniam Gamai of NSN was third, Max Kanter of XDS Astana was fourth, Jasper Philipsen fifth again. I think he was fifth in Poe as well. Yes, indeed he was. So consistent, if nothing else. Phil Bauhaus was sixth, Hoob Arts was seventh, Dorian Godon of Net Company Ineos was eighth, Mads Pedersen was ninth, and with those intermediate sprint points, he is, well, at the moment, running away with the green jersey competition, 204 points, with Biniam Gamai on 145 and Max Kanter on 140. But another big day tomorrow for the sprinters. But we really should talk about Tim Malia, the man of the day today.
Yeah, I mean, it shows you how important those intermediate sprints are, with Biniam Gamai and Max Kanter in second and third place on the green jersey competition. But Tim Malia is, to my eye, saving himself for the stage wins and the green jersey. You know, if it comes as a product of those stage wins, a little bit like Olav Kooi, then great. And maybe that's something they will focus on towards the end of the race if things go their way.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some similarities with Olav Kooi. He hasn't got a nickname that is a fish, Graham. The carp, Olav Kooi. I mean, that's catching on already, Graham.
I'm very pleased to hear it. Yeah, great. But, well, you have to get a T-shirt made.
But Kooi had a very disrupted and very late start to his season, really late start, didn't start racing until the end of May. Tim Malia has had a really difficult start to the year too, and it all goes back to late November, when he took part in the Bonen and Friends charity cyclocross race, which was held in Mull, and it's kind of a bit like a pro-am golf event, although not many amateurs taking part, but pros and ex-pros, an exhibition, a sort of Kermesse-style, Criterium-style fun event to raise money for charity, organised and run by Tom Bonan, of course, multiple Tour de France stage winner, green jersey winner, Classics King, of course. Tim Melier, after riding that, he won it, actually. He started to feel knee pain, didn't know what was causing it, hesitated to blame the cyclocross because he's often done cyclocross, he's Belgian, he's often done cyclocross in the winter, but the knee injury, the pain, didn't clear up and it disrupted his December training camp and his January training camp, and he didn't actually start his season until pretty late, actually at the GP Jean-Pierre Montserrat towards the end of March, and then he had another sort of 2-3 weeks off and rode Scheldeprijs, which he won. And he's been consistent, winning races, Ronde van Limburg as well, three stages of the Tour de Hongrie, and then a stage in the Baloise Belgium Tour. But, you know, that's a fairly modest build-up to a race of this size and stature against what is quite a stacked field of sprinters. So it's not been an easy ride for him to get to this point.
As it was in Belgium, a stacked field for the Baloise Belgium Tour, and the sprint stages were shared out pretty much equally among Girmay, Philipsen, Coy and Melier. Hopefully, that's what we will continue to see here.
Well, we'll see tomorrow, won't we? Because a couple of sprinters have really got to get level with Coy and Melier. But did you see Melier's celebration where he brushed the shoulders?
I was down at the buses, so I missed it.
You miss everything down at the buses, don't you?
Yeah. I miss most things, certainly in the last 5 kilometres.
Generally, I don't mean you, Graham. I mean, you know, when you're down at the buses, it's very hard to keep tabs on what's going on. But he did a little brush of the shoulders celebration, and he was asked in the press conference what that was about. And before the tour, the team had a meeting, and he was kind of, it was somebody else in the meeting said, "Tim, we can feel you are under a lot of pressure. You've just got to relax, let it go. It's the Tour de France, enjoy it, just do what comes naturally." And I think he was sort of signifying that the pressure is off his shoulders somewhat.
So, Lionel, let's cast an eye back to yesterday, because we need to go over a few things. There was a tiff that we mentioned sort of in passing yesterday, but it's well worth going into.
Well, I missed all the beef at the Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe bus, because obviously I was up at the finish line. But it started up at the finish line. I'd been kicked out by Emmanuel Macron's security, of course. But when he came over the line, Evenepoel was not happy with something, and it was his teammate, Florian Lipovic. And the fact that he had asked Lipovic to set the pace a bit for a kilometre on the Tourmalet, and Lipovic said no, he couldn't. Now, Remco Evenepoel then said, "Well, back in Catalonia, I rode on the front for him for 30k, and I asked him for 1k, and he won't do it." And
that made me angry.
And Remco Evenepoel then rode down 20Ks from the finish line to the team bus, got into the team bus, had a shower, got some food, came out to talk to more media, and basically said the same thing again, just slightly calmer. And so this kicked off the first sort of significant beef of the Tour de France. It's the 40th anniversary of Le Mans versus Eno, the Lavie-Claire tug of war. Who's going to win the Tour between the two teammates? I mean, this is a bit of a decaffeinated version of that, because really they're racing for third, aren't they?
Yeah.
But this is an uneasy kind of alliance between Evenepoel and Florian Lipovic. Overnight, it's all calmed down a bit. Ralph Denk, I think, was at the start this morning basically saying the party line, which is that it's all fine now, and they've chatted about it and they had dinner together, and it's sort of all laughs and smiles again.
They were made to sit next to each other at dinner and weren't allowed any dinner until I'm making this up, just to be clear, weren't allowed any dinner until they had settled their differences.
No pudding till you shake hands, boys. But this is really interesting, I think, because they're two very different types of riders, aren't they? Florian Lipovic was the breakthrough rider of last year's Tour de France. He finished third, but he did so in a very unflappable sort of way. You know, he's a steady eddy, a solid rider. You get the feeling that he will ride round on the coattails and see where that takes him. And if it takes him to third, that's good enough. If it were to take him to second, fantastic. Whereas Remco Evenepoel is a bona fide big star in the sport. And he's, of course, joined Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe in a, you know, a hugely publicised sort of transfer tug of war as with Sudal Quickstep.
The sort of willy, won't he, as well.
Yeah. The money is huge. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that Remco Evenepoel is one of the top five, if not one of the top three highest paid riders in the world. I mean, Tadej Pogacar, of course, number one. Evenepoel signed his contract after Jonas Vingegaard, so it's possible that Evenepoel's on more money even than Vingegaard. The others up there, I mean, Tom Pidcock's slightly unusual because he was still getting paid some of his Ineos money, having moved across to Pinarello, Q36.5. Matthew van der Poel will be up there on the high earner list as well. But Evenepoel is one of the biggest and most expensive stars. He's being paid Tour de France winning money, but he's not a Tour de France winning rider. He's just not the right profile. Mm. And I think he's in this really difficult situation at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, especially with Lipovic being just so solid and dependable so far.
And a better rider in the mountains, if you were to go one side or the other. Lipovic, of course, is well used to riding with beef. Primoz Roglic, maybe not to the same extent, but Primoz Roglic last year at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe in the mountains kind of just buzzed off and did his own thing towards the end of the race. And Lipovic was, as you say, sort of quite happy to float on the coattails and kind of measure his own race.
The thing is, Graham, Remco Evenepoel is a Grand Tour champion. He won the Vuelta in 2022. But when I look back to remind myself of how that race went, I mean, he was ahead of Enric Mas, a good rider, but, you know, quite limited, certainly in terms of, like, punch in any kind of race, even in the mountains. And Juan Ayuso was third, who was riding his first Grand Tour at the age of 19. But other than that, Evenepoel's Grand Tour record is a bit spotty, isn't it? He didn't finish the Giro in 2021. He was very well placed overall, slipped out of the top 10 and pulled out. He didn't finish the Giro in 2023. He took the pink jersey in individual time trial before the rest day and then pulled out before the race resumed. He was 12th in the 2023 Vuelta. The standout result at the Tour was third in 24. You were here, Graham, but behind Pogacar and Vingegaard, and significantly behind, almost
third,
10 minutes down, wasn't he? 9.18, I think, was the gap. And then, of course, last year, all of that hullabaloo about the transfer, you know, he did so well to win the time trial in Caen.
Yeah.
But when it got to the mountains, he was just burned out. And this year, he's raced so lightly. But his palmares, you know, world road race champion, time trial champion multiple times, Olympic Games road race and time trial, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He is world class at cycling. But has he got the attributes for a Tour de France? If you can't match Pogacar, you've got to be one of those steady eddy type riders to kind of get round in fourth or fifth place.
Even with a time trial heavy course like we saw for Bradley Wiggins in 2012, I still think he would be off the pace.
Yeah. And the difference with Lipovic is he's clearly a talent, but in the pecking order, if you just, okay, let's show us your medals, so to speak, Evenepoel absolutely trounces Lipovic. Lipovic has won the Czech Tour, the Sibiu Tour in Romania, and the Tour of Slovenia last month. Yes, he was third in the Tour de France last year, and he's been third in Catalunya, second in Itzulia, second at Romandy, and then that Slovenia win that I mentioned. So he's solid and steady, but he's not flamboyant. He's not a kind of on or off the bike, a larger-than-life character. The camera doesn't immediately go to him the same way it goes to Remco Evenepoel. And so I feel for Evenepoel, really, because, like I say, the salary is huge. The expectation is enormous, not least because he's Belgian as well. And there's all that to factor into it. But the Tour de France at the moment is just not made for him, especially with a rider like Pogacar around.
So, Lionel, we knew that we'd lost the yellow jersey. We've already mentioned it, and Torhushov has already mentioned it in my chat with him. But the train has not only left the station, but it's left the Tour.
Yeah, it's pulled into a siding, unfortunately. That's the extent of my train knowledge. I'm not a train spotter. Torstein train exactly did what everyone would expect yesterday, honoured the yellow jersey. Maybe he knew at that point, I'm not going any further than this, my knee is too painful. So if that is the case, I mean, hats off to him for battling to the top of the climb, and to his teammate it was Anders Halland Johannesson, wasn't it?
Yeah,
who stayed, stayed with him.
Should we read out the Uno X media statement, or at least parts of it?
Go for
it. So, Thorstein passed the roadside concussion assessment after the crash on the descent of the Tourmalet and was able to continue to the finish. However, following further assessment by the Uno X mobility medical staff, analysis of the data from his helmet sensor and x-rays in the medical truck, he has been diagnosed with a concussion and multiple rib fractures. So that's an awful lot to carry around with you if you were to continue. And well, there's no doubt they've made the right decision.
Even more so. I mean, I must admit, I thought it was his knee because his knee was quite bashed. But yeah, fractured ribs and concussion, no way he can carry on. I mean, the Tour de France does sometimes lose riders who've held the yellow jersey. I mean, that's the sort of capricious nature of the Tour. You can be up 1 minute and completely on the floor the next, you know, literally as well as metaphorically. Remember last year, Jasper Philipsen won the opening stage, took the yellow jersey, and 2 days later crashed out.
I was about to say, knowing the answer, when was the last time the yellow jersey crashed out of the Tour? But we didn't have to go
you
for
knew
long.
The
did we?
Answer, Graham. We were there, weren't we?
We were
there. But it has happened a lot over the last sort of 20 years. Matthew van der Poel has pulled out a couple of times because last year he had the yellow jersey and didn't start the Mont Ventoux stage. 2021, he had the yellow jersey, made everyone's life a misery for a week by attacking everywhere.
Just bombing then, off the front.
And then went off home and then went on holiday and left everyone else to it.
What a way to go. Yeah. Fantastic.
Fernando Gaviria.
Real Cipollini would have been proud.
Yeah, he would. Fernando Gaviria, who we saw a brief flash of today, didn't we? Where did Gaviria finish in the end? 14th. He was right up there, shoulder to shoulder, until he was kind of impeded a little by Philipsen. But when he won the stage on his very first day at the Tour in 2018 and took the yellow jersey, he kind of pulled out at the end of the first week, imagining they were saving this great talent for, you know, not putting him through the whole 3 week ordeal.
Well, he's here with Carhartt Rouaul, isn't he? Fernando Gaviria. We've seen how good he's been in the past, never quite fulfilled his potential, but the fact that they are a wild card, his team, Carhartt Rouaul, we saw them represented in the break today, the break of two today, but they've not really animated the race. They've not kind of done that wild card silent agreement with ASO of, look, we're a wild card, so our job will be, we will, that kind of unspoken agreement is, we will animate the race. And I think that's part of the reason why Baptiste Verstappen has been out on his own for so long so far this Tour.
I mean, let's give Alex Molinar his due, because he went out, targeted the polka dot jersey and was aggressive. So I think maybe, like teams do, the first three or four days are for Molinar and then somebody else comes to the fore to look after the next few days. We might see different riders trying something over the rest of the race. But yeah, it's been, well, I mean, it's been so unforgiving racing. And on these flat days, every rider knows this is a hiding to nothing. You're just riding out there on your own in the wind all day. And it takes some fortitude to do that, knowing that really it's going to be a fruitless task.
I'm going to give you an actual footnote, which is that Josh Tarling is riding with a cracked rib as well.
Just on the yellow jerseys who crashed out finally. The closest to Thorstein Train's kind of experience would be Tony Martin. 2015, he was in yellow when he crashed on the run into Le Havre and then didn't start the next day. I'm doubly glad, really, that Train made it to the line and got the warmth of that applause as he made it up there yesterday. Wish him all the best.
Tadej Pogacar still in yellow.
He is. Well, will we be talking about Tadej Pogacar not finishing the Tour? I highly doubt it, but we'll return to that in a moment.
Lionel, we've had a fair few questions on a certain subject, haven't we?
Well, we've had lots of questions on lots of subjects, actually, Graham. We're going to revive the press conference episode on the rest day. We've already got a fair few questions. If you would like to send a question, please do. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com is the email address. There's a link to something called SpeakPipe, a new device to me, but you can basically click on it and record your voice note and it gets sent directly to us. We'd love to hear your questions in your actual voice if you are willing.
Wouldn't that be great? I would love that. A little change of pace, change of voice.
Absolutely. Stop me yakking on.
I wasn't what I was getting at, but okay.
I know it was, Graham. I know it was. We've been on the road over a week.
Falling out on stage 7. That's no good.
This is the bit where we start falling out, isn't it? The honeymoon period is over. We haven't even reached the end of the first week yet, but we're still on good terms, everyone. Don't worry.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
But, do send us a question. The SpeakPipe link is in our show notes. You can just click on it, record your question, and we will answer as many as we can on the rest day and some in the regular episodes. But thank you to several people who've all raised the question of Tadej Pogacar's dominance, the performance yesterday. And it's a valid question, isn't it? I mean, we can't look at the recent or indeed long-term past of cycling without questioning what we're seeing. We do it every time someone appears to have the yellow jersey sewn up. But thank you especially to Mark and Leo and Jennifer for their thoughtful emails. Jennifer says, I don't believe what I'm witnessing anymore, to the point I'm no longer watching cycling on TV where he, Pogacar, is racing or could win. You said in the episode you haven't seen anything quite like it in 40 years covering the Tour, and we know that's not quite true, is it? You owe it to cycling and your listeners to question it, otherwise everyone looks very foolish. Very valid question. Corrections Corner, I haven't been covering the Tour for 40 years. I might look like it or perhaps sound like it. I've been watching the Tour for 40 years, covering it since 99 on and off. But it actually is true. I haven't seen anything like Pogacar. I mean, Lance Armstrong used to demolish people in the mountains by attacking with 7 or 8 kilometres to go on the final mountain.
And that's the reference here, isn't it? Yeah. The most obvious reference point.
But the thing is here that Pogacar, I long gave up, vouching for anyone in professional cycling for obvious reasons. We've seen scandal after scandal. We've got a kind of eerily quiet period, I think, on the anti-doping front now. It's strange. There's no rumours or there's no gossip about it in the amongst the team staff or any of that kind of thing, which it seems unnaturally quiet in a way, almost as if the sport as a whole has sort of decided that it's not the sort of territory we want to get into because it never ends well, right?
Yeah.
But the thing that I think the bluntest tool when it comes to deciding whether or not there's anything to be suspicious of is purely the performance, because somebody has to be the best. And this is going to start sounding like a defence of Tadej Pogacar, and it isn't. But the evidence of the last 5 years suggests that yesterday's performance was not that unusual. Yes, he attacked 40 kilometres from the end, but he's been doing this for the last 3 or 4 years, hasn't he? Strade Bianche was the first real time we saw this. And what year was that? 2022?
Yeah.
Demolishing people by attacking so far out.
He was asked about the rebreather last year, so these questions have come up, but not in a way that we're necessarily familiar with, and not in the way that you would sort of consider the old school methods, I suppose, the kind of late 80s into all the way through the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something we'll return to in greater depth. I know someone who I could go and speak to maybe over the next couple of days who would have a really interesting perspective on just how we should appraise Tadej Pogacar. Are we seeing the greatest of the greatest of all time, or is there something that we should be looking deeper at? And I understand the questions about the team, UAE Team Emirates, and especially the boss, Mauro Gianetti. I mean, he has a murky past as a rider. We can't deny it. 30 years ago, he almost killed himself by taking a substance, his name escapes me.
Erythropoietin?
No, it was a version of a blood-boosting drug. I'll do my research before we read.
Well, that's it, though, isn't it? We need to take a breath, do a little bit of research in this, and talk to people who know a little bit more about it than we do. But that's not to say that we're just letting this kind of fly by either.
No, I think yesterday's performance was extraordinary, and I haven't seen anything like it in 40 years of watching the Tour. I certainly haven't seen anything as consistent as Pogacar over the last so many years. I mean, some of the best bike riders who've ever lived are racing now. I would say they're all the best bike riders that have ever lived, because the level of performance is so high. The technological advances, the knowledge about fueling and hydrating and cooling, you know, these things have carried on at such a rate of advancement over the last few years. And I know that to people listening, because I've think it myself, you think, well, these are just all kind of, well, it's going to be the cool mattresses, or it's going to be the the skin suit, or it's the bikes, or it's whatever. But I genuinely do think on that front the speed of the peloton is such that every aspect of the sport is light years away from where it was even 10 years ago, I think. And the way it's raced, the stages are shorter, they're more intense in a lot of ways. And Pogacar's performance really has to be judged on the current scene. He is head and shoulders above others. But I think we get into the use of language, don't we? On another planet, superhuman effort.
Alien.
And that gets taken as a code word for, well, he must be doping. We don't know. And I think it's a dangerous one to say, well, one or two members of the team staff may have murky histories. Walk around the team bus paddock and there are sports directors who were caught doping or doped and weren't caught. Pretty much wherever you look, because of the age of the people and the way the sport was then. So I don't even think that necessarily is enough. But I do think the eerie silence about the whole anti-doping landscape is just a bit weird. But
too quiet.
Yeah, but I don't know. I've asked people, you know, why do you think that is? But there's no sort of real credible kind of analysis or answer to that. But what I would say is that just judging Pogacar on the time difference that he's managed to beat Vingegaard by, I don't think is quite enough to just say in the stage recap episode, oh, well, this looks murky. Now, it may very well be. But what I would say for the whole sport, you know, everybody involved, the race organisers, the UCI, the team owners, the media, the fans, every single person who has any kind of interest in the sport, the one thing that is the case is that if this castle is built on sand, the whole, I mean, there's literally no point. There is literally no point to the sport. So, you know, at some point, I know they say, fool me once, fool me twice, or whatever the quote is. I've been fooled plenty of times by professional cycling. I'm still here. I look at it with very different eyes now to how I did in 1999 when I first met David Walsh and asked him very starry-eyed what he thought of, who he thought was going to win the Tour. But look, it's a subject that we'll perhaps delve into with a few other people over the coming days and see what, you know, take the temperature of the Tour de France and see what people think.
So from one yellow jersey to another, one four-time winner of the Tour de France to another, Chris Froome, we've seen him a fair few times around the village. He's back at the Tour de France. He confirmed in an interview before the Tour that he's retired, and there's this question of whether or not he was going to find another team, and whether or not he had successfully made his way back from another life-threatening crash.
Chris Froome, good morning. Welcome
morning.
Back to the Tour de France. Good to have you back. The recently retired Chris Froome, I should say.
Well,
and you dropped that on us all, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I obviously knew it was time. I knew over 5 years ago when I signed my last contract that would be the last contract. But then obviously I had that big crash in at the end of August last year, and that had me recovering for the best part of 4 or 5 months in and out of hospital. So I really just kind of never really got around to speaking about it publicly. So being back here at the Tour de France felt like a perfect time to at least talk about it and make it official in that sense.
Sure, because the feeling was that because it was almost accidentally dropped into an interview, it felt, for the wider public kind of point of view, the feeling was that you might have been wrestling with that decision for a little while.
Not at all.
Just a straight
wasn't
thing.
No, it was never a question for me.
Yeah, and how are the injuries? Like your most recent crash, another really difficult one to recover from. How are you doing on that?
I'm doing fine now, but this was very nasty, a very nasty crash. I'm very lucky to be here today. It really could have gone either way, so I'm extremely grateful that I am here, and I've got my career behind me now, and I can enjoy life ahead with my family.
And looking really well on it too.
Interesting to hear from Chris Froome there. My sense is how quickly you become yesterday's man. I mean, it's a long time since Chris Froome won the Tour de France, but for several years in a row, he was facing the kind of questions and speculation and raised eyebrows that Tadej Pogacar will no doubt face over the next couple of weeks. In a way, Chris Froome's career, you know, quite sad the way it ended, and I kind of wonder, you know, the determination to carry on and keep coming back eventually, I think age was against him. The clock beats everyone in the end.
It does. A bit of a hurried interview that. It was hardly Frost Nixon, was it? But I was only allowed a couple of minutes from the PR, and you know, we all know what Chris Froome is like. He's very, very guarded, and I think that was particularly the case today. But good to hear from him, and good to see him back and looking so well at the tour.
Well, let's briefly talk about last night's dinner before we go for tonight's dinner. We managed to get a tartiflette in Luz Saint-Sauveur. Now, tartiflette is officially an Alpine dish. Francois would be here telling me that it's not a real dish because it was invented relatively recently, I think in the 1970s, by a marketing executive who wanted to flog loads of reblochon cheese, so came up with a recipe that used lots of reblochon cheese. Our version at least had a Pyrenean cheese, which was and it was very nice, wasn't it? Just what we needed.
It was just what we needed, and it was quick, and it meant that we could get off the mountain and back to our lodgings in reasonably good time, back to Pau.
In time to see the end of France beating Morocco, and I slept through the French fans celebrating for an hour by honking their car horns. I don't know how I managed that, but that kept you up, I think, Graham.
Yeah, I just sort of wanted to see a little bit of post-match analysis, and apologies for another football, well, no apologies maybe for another football mention, but almost as soon as the final whistle blew, the French football fans of Pau got excited and did so for the next 45 minutes, but well done on sleeping through it. That's impressive.
I'm tired, Graham. Let's hope Remco Evenepoel has a smile on his face tomorrow. He's an ex-footballer, of course, used to play for Anderlecht, or certainly one of their sort of age group teams as he was a teenager, I think, maybe even got to under 19 or something before he switched to cycling. Oh no, he wouldn't have been stuck with football till that late, would he? But he switched.
There's a benchmark at 18. Yeah, there's a very good interview with him in The Athletic.
Yeah, so Evenepoel will be rooting for Belgium tonight. Maybe he could ask Florian Lipovic how Germany got on in the World Cup this year at breakfast tomorrow and see if that improves relations.
Anyway.
just a couple of things to mention before we go. The 1101 Cappuccino, which is our Substack, goes out semi-regularly. It's been on the back burner this week while we've been covering the Tour de France, but an edition of that will go out very shortly. There's a couple of Kilometre Zero episodes as well, covering the 1986 Tour de France, a nice eclectic mix of memories there. Final instalment of that comes tomorrow morning, featuring the Canadian rider Alex Steeder and his incredible story from the 86 Tour. Daniel's Sexass series is continuing. I think the next episode of that will be on Monday. Graham, we really ought to go for dinner, a sort of British Bordeaux-themed dinner.
Sure. Let's see what we can find. Sure, there's a steak frite around there somewhere.
Oh,
steak and chips.
I was thinking of a Sherlock Holmes pipe or a Winston Churchill cigar and a glass of claret, maybe.
Before we go, one last thing. Tomorrow's stage is likely to be, well, it's certainly going to be a case of déjà vu. Perigeux, just on the outskirts of Bordeaux to Bergerac. Only the two Cat 4 categorised climbs to go on the way. And, I mean, we're going to see the same again, I think.
Well, we'll see, won't we? Will it be Coy? Will it be Malia? Will it be Philipson? Will it be somebody else? We'll be back roughly this time tomorrow to let everybody know. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Graham.
Thanks, Holmes.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.